Good afternoon. My name is Tanya, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the Advances in Antimicrobial Stewardship, Integrating Infection Prevention and Marketing Success to the Executive Team Conference Call. Thank you. I would now like to turn the call over to Ms. Lauren Solis from Premier, Inc. Ma'am, you may begin.
Hey, thank you, Tanya, and good afternoon to everyone from Charlotte, North Carolina, and welcome to Premier's Advisor Live Series. I've got a few quick announcements today before I turn the call over to your host. As stated, this teleconference is being recorded and will be posted to the Advisor Live homepage at premierinc.com within 48 hours. Look for an email tomorrow with specific instructions on how to access all of today's materials. Following today's presentation, the operator will instruct you how to ask questions. You may also submit them at any time during the program through the chat feature on your screen. While we are compiling a list of participant questions, I will ask you to complete a brief on-screen survey about today's program. I'd like to thank you in advance for your comments and recommendations. It really helps us develop future programs. I'd now like to turn the call over to Scott Pope. He's Premier's National Director for the Safety Connect program and your host for today's call. Scott?
Thank you very much, Lauren, and thank you all for joining. As Lauren mentioned, I am the National Director for Premier's Safety Connect program, and as a clinical pharmacist, this topic of this particular advisor live is very near and dear to my heart, focusing on antimicrobial stewardship efforts. Each one of our speakers today, very distinguished speakers, are going to be talking about individual success stories that they've experienced at their specific hospitals and things that they've done to, one, promote success of their program, as well as to integrate infection control, and really speaking from real-life experience, very excited to hear some of the presentations that we get and certainly some of the questions towards the end of the conference as well. Again, it is my pleasure to introduce our first speaker of the day, Dr. Lynn Fehrenbacher, the PharmD and BCPS. She's the Infectious Disease Pharmacy Clinical Coordinator at Aurora St. Luke's Medical Center in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Received her bachelor's and doctor of pharmacy degrees from the University of Wisconsin, actually the location on which I am standing, and completed a pharmacy practice residency with Aurora Healthcare. Dr. Fehrenbacher currently serves as a collaborative liaison to ID physicians and is involved in development of antimicrobial stewardship practices on campus there at Aurora. She's also an adjunct professor for Concordia University of Wisconsin's graduate nursing program, as well as an active member of ACCP, the IDPRN, and the Society of Infectious Diseases Pharmacists. So it's with great pleasure that I introduce to you Dr. Lynn Fehrenbacher. Lynn?
Thank you, Scott, and I'd like to send along my greetings to you all from Wisconsin, where Scott's about 90 miles away from me. I'm in Milwaukee. And also, thank you for joining, and let you know that I am battling a little bit of a cold, so if I get a little hoarse, please forgive me. I'll try to keep my water close by so that I can speak as smoothly as possible for you. As mentioned, I'm going to take about the first 15 or 20 minutes to share with you some of our success stories here at Aurora St. Luke's Medical Center in Milwaukee. We're a large community-based hospital with an average census typically running in the mid-400s, if that gives you a little bit better perspective of my practice. But we are part of a 13-hospital system, so some of what I'm going to speak to you on today also has been expanded to some of the smaller hospitals within the system. So I guess bottom take-home point is that I think some of the things that we're going to discuss on this call can be applied to any practice, no matter how big or small. Next slide, please. So just a couple of simple objectives, and keeping in mind that we have a diverse audience on this call, my perspective is that of the clinical pharmacist. So while some of the slides that we go through, for those of you especially in the infection control realm, may seem somewhat basic, I think really understanding how to connect with your clinical pharmacy department will prove to be beneficial. And that's why the first objective is to understand the role of infection prevention and control and advocate for pharmacist involvement if you don't already have that at your site. And then my second objective for you today is to provide some examples of collaborative stewardship projects that have worked here that you can maybe take to your sites if you're not already doing so. Next slide. Just a little bit about infection control departments in general, and again, this is for you non-IPC folks on the call, but in the last few years, many have been renamed, and I think appropriately so, infection prevention and control, because we'd like to prevent that infection rather than control it once it's gotten into our patients' care units. So just sharing with you the mission statement for our IPC here at St. Luke's, and I want to tease out a few key points from this mission statement. You can see that we're committed to identifying and minimizing, reducing, or eliminating basically risk of infections. But I think this next line is important, is paramount. Really, we're looking at it in our patients, our visitors, our caregivers, our volunteers, and all others in the organization and in the community. And I would say that with some of the things that we're discussing, while they seem very minute, while they seem very narrow in focus, there is that outreach out into the general population. So please keep that in mind as we're discussing some things that seem small. I actually gave a very similar talk about a week or two ago to our state Pharmacy Society meeting, and I at that time was able to have technology to poll the audience. And this was my poll the audience question from that meeting. So there's several potential scenarios whether or not a pharmacist is involved at your practice site in the IPC. And basically we were split between, I'd say, the second and third fairly evenly. So there are a handful of folks who had a pharmacist as a very active member of their infection prevention and control team or committee, but the majority responded that a pharmacist attended the meetings but had little involvement other than presence or maybe cursory review when something came up involving an antibiotic directly. And then several folks also stated that the pharmacy department was peripherally involved with the IPC, but there wasn't a pharmacist on the committee, so they were essentially an ad hoc member. And another handful reported that there was no established relationship at all between pharmacy and the IPC department, which I think is very unfortunate, and hopefully we can convince you that if you don't have a strong, active relationship, there are definite ways you can collaborate. Next slide. So why should we do this? I mean, are we doing it just to create more work? Are we doing it just to be friends? While I think it's great to, you know, have interdisciplinary care, I think there's some stronger mandates that dictate for us to go in this direction. Number one, the Joint Commission. Obviously, we want to listen to what they say, and the 2009-2010 National Patient Safety Goals, I'm sure you're intimately familiar with goal number 7, to reduce the risk of healthcare-associated infections. To follow up, another reason why, the Infectious Diseases Society of America Antimicrobial Stewardship Guidelines state that collaboration between the antimicrobial stewardship team, hospital infection control, and pharmacy and therapeutics committees or their equivalents is essential. And that's a very high-level recommendation. So two bodies who say it's important. And guess what? There's a few more. The World Health Organization also recognizes the importance of collaboration, and they state that the most effective infection control team consists of, and I highlighted pharmacists here just because that's the angle that we're taking, but basically identifying that pharmacy representation on the team is very important. I'm going to flip the coin a little bit because I think for the pharmacists on the call, sometimes you hesitate to extend out and spread yourself thinner, but I'd argue that it's a very symbiotic relationship. Infection control committees and departments have extremely valuable information. Many of the committees and departments develop toolkits or learning modules that are definitely pertinent to pharmacy staff education, your pharmacist and your pharmacy technician. Oftentimes they have websites and manuals directing you to internal policies, which come in very handy for survey time. Next slide. This is just an example of a screenshot of our infection control's homepage, and I think it provides those of you who may be less familiar with the infection control side of antimicrobial stewardship with a brief overview of some of the key things that infection control has in their information arsenal. You can see here they have the different types of isolation precautions. So if you have a pharmacist working who's not quite sure what they need to do to go into a certain room, in addition to any signage that you may have, there may be a resource available through your infection control, and that's a great teaching point, as well as new clinical policies and procedures that we've worked on as an interdisciplinary team, such as our new system, MRSA policy and procedure. So bottom line of this slide is get to know what information is out there from your infection control department and make sure that's very transparent to your pharmacy staff. Next slide. And a couple of more reasons. I think it's easy for us as pharmacists especially to note that if there's data out there that someone else is collecting and we can use it, that's a great opportunity to piggyback. So our programs here track internal data that help us know what's going on in our hospital so that we can then take a global look in terms of antimicrobial usage, et cetera, and identify opportunities for intervention. And many hospitals submit to the NHSN, the National Healthcare Safety Network. And three examples as they relate to infection control are central line infections, ventilator-associated pneumonia, and catheter-associated urinary tract infections. So, again, for those of you who are intimately involved in infection control, this slide may seem somewhat kindergarten in its nature, but I think it is important to remember that many people are unfamiliar with infection control markers, and if you said NHSN to a room full of pharmacists, I'd argue there may only be a handful that know what that stands for. So you can take this back and educate your pharmacy department. What is it? Well, it's essentially an internet-based surveillance system that's facilitated by the CDC and the NIH. And NHSN basically has a couple of purposes as applicable to this discussion, but they collect data from a sample of facilities and allow us to estimate adverse events, adherence to practices, and other ways that we can incorporate that data into benchmarking, trending, and collaborative research. So if you are a member of NHSN or reporting data, it's a very useful tool. If you're not, it may be something that's worth exploring. Next slide. This map depicts a map of states that have facilities using NHSN, and you can see that every state in the United States has at least one facility using NHSN, so obviously a very powerful benchmarking tool. You can see, though, even more interesting in the darker blue color, that there are approximately half the states, slightly under half the states in the country, that actually mandate hospital-associated infection reporting using NHSN. And looking down to the future, I would argue that the country is going to become much more dark blue in nature with respect to that. So if you don't know about NHSN now, the likelihood of you coming across it sometime in the future as mandated reporting extends further across the country is pretty high. Next slide. So really, this is great. This is all basic information about infection control and prevention committees. But what does that mean? How can we translate that into something that we can correlate into a stewardship project? Well, I'm just going to kind of give you the basics and my approach for when I start something new. Before I start any new stewardship project, I typically check with one of our IPC providers to see if the data are already being collected. And you'd be surprised at how often there are data available that you can use, and then you don't have to go through the mundane practice of just number crunching and chart review. So if you can springboard off of their hard work, why not go for it? I think certain things that we need to address are somewhat outside of the realm of pharmacy, such as compliance with isolation and hand hygiene. And we can get that information from our IPC groups. The NHSN reports, it's great to see how we benchmark compared to other institutions so we can narrow our focus to, say, one ICU that needs more attention than others and work with the pharmacists that are in that unit. Obviously, other quality measures that they're following, such as surgical site infections. And they're obviously frontline in identifying outbreaks and trending. So some of the pathogens that are on my radar are Clostridium difficile, all the multi-drug resistant organisms, as well as the CDC alerts and local assessment and response plans, as exemplified by the H1N1 outbreak this past spring. So the one challenge for the pharmacists in the audience that I want to throw out there is, please, when it comes to infection control and prevention, and even your bottom line antimicrobial budget, think outside of the drug box. Going back again to the basics, perhaps the single largest step to prevent infection and spread is hand hygiene and proper hand washing, and obeying the isolation requirements of your institution as rooms are labeled. One thing I think that many infection control providers may not know is that direct pharmacist-patient interaction on the hospital side is increasing in many inpatient settings. It used to be that pharmacists went into hospital pharmacy if you didn't want to talk to patients. If you did, you went into retail or clinic-based pharmacies. And now that's not the case so much anymore. We're in the rooms quite often. I'd say I go into patient rooms multiple times daily, whether it's to do med histories or medication reconciliation, whether it's rounding with the team, code situations, or just doing patient education. So the best thing that we can do is be a good example and hold everyone accountable. So whether or not you do any education on an annual basis outside of just your institutional requirements is up to you, but I would recommend that staff meetings, et cetera, keep this on the front lines, especially this fall with flu season, that hand hygiene is paramount. Teach your students and pharmacy residents that come through in training. Every ID resident on rotation with me has to gown and glove at least once so that they're comfortable doing it. And also remind your colleagues regularly, staff meetings, newsletters, and be bold and brave enough to give feedback if someone is doing something that could endanger themselves or a patient by not practicing proper hand hygiene. So I just wanted to share one success story and very briefly with you and see if it's something you might be able to apply. Clostridium difficile is obviously a problem across the country and across the world. And we realized that within our own institution, there were actions that we could take to partner with our IPC folks to help reduce delay of therapy, et cetera. Our IPC folks are alerted to cases, of course, but not all IPC practitioners will assess the patient for appropriate therapy. A couple of reasons for this is that some may not be able to assess the patient in real time. They may be looking at the data retrospectively. And this is where we really saw potential for pharmacist assessment and facilitation. Next slide. So what we found is that our hospitals, we were able to work with our IS folks and design a C. diff toxin positive report. We do have an EICU, which is an off-site ICU where a pharmacist is present. It's basically a peripheral monitoring station, a virtual ICU monitoring station that looks at all of the ICUs across our system. But they essentially get the report, they review all new toxin positive patients, and they assess for the presence of appropriate treatment according to our internal guideline, which is based off of the reference that I noted for you at the bottom of this slide. In addition, they're assessing for antidiarrheal agents and recommend removing them, and they do an antimicrobial therapy review and really try to get aggressive de-escalation when possible. That's communicated with the on-site ICU pharmacist, so they're really saving them time by doing that first cut. And in the future, we're hoping to trigger this review using computer-based surveillance alerts. So our intended outcomes are that patients are treated in a more timely manner. There's not a day or two that goes by before the identification of the positive toxin. That patients are on appropriate treatment, so they're not just on metronidazole 500 milligrams twice daily. We have them on appropriate therapy, as well as it really increased awareness by the pharmacists of what C. diff treatment recommendations are, the importance of timely de-escalation to prevent C. diff and to help this patient heal as quickly as possible, as well as the infection control considerations for patients with C. diff, such as washing hands versus using hand gel. Kind of the next partnership project that we're in the middle of, actually the late stages of getting started, is addressing catheter-associated UTIs, which I see as one of the highest misuses of the fluoroquinolone classes here at our campus, is unnecessarily treating asymptomatic bacteriuria. And per our NHSN requirements, surveillance must be performed on at least one inpatient unit for at least one calendar month each year. And the numerator data is the number of total catheter-associated UTIs identified. The denominator is device days and patient days. So the next slide will show you a flow chart that our infection control practitioners use to assess patients and really determine whether or not this is a true catheter-associated UTI. And the purpose for including this flow chart was just to let those of you not working in infection control to have a visual of how standardized this process is so we can compare apples to apples. Next slide. So what we've decided to do, again, is piggyback onto their surveillance, and they're providing us with a list of patients evaluated. We can also search this as a tag in our computer-based surveillance tool. For patients classified as not having a symptomatic catheter-associated UTI, a pharmacist or pharmacy resident is assessing whether or not this was actually asymptomatic bacteria that was inappropriately treated. In addition, we're reviewing for any negative sequelae that would be attributable to the antibiotic, such as a C. diff infection, adverse drug reactions, such as QT prolongation from a fluoroquinolone. And also, we plan to kind of take this, essentially, to report the findings and develop education. I don't want to bias it by saying, you know, this is going to save us thousands of dollars, because we don't know the magnitude of the problem yet. It's mostly anecdotal on observation and seeing that people are being overtreated. But I think we will be able to correlate this with some bottom-line cost savings once we get actual numbers behind it. Next slide. So in summary, I just wanted to give you a couple of take-home bullet points. So if you as a pharmacist or you as an infection control practitioner are lacking a pharmacist presence as an active member of the IPC, I encourage you to explore the opportunity. There's obviously many high-level bodies that recommend this as well, not just me. And I think the fact that we think alike, infection control practitioners are data-driven, and us pharmacists, we're very type A data-driven, and we both can piggyback and springboard off each other's data. There's numerous opportunities for collaboration. So whether or not these two examples will help you, they may or may not, but I encourage you to work with your ICP department and find some ideas that will. So with that, I will throw it back to Scott Pope, who will introduce our next speaker. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Lynn. A very well-delivered presentation, and certainly identified some very key areas for integration and reasons for integration between antimicrobial stewardship and infection control, infection prevention. It is my pleasure again to introduce our second very distinguished presenter of the day. Dr. Eric Schindler is a PharmD and BCPS. He's the clinical pharmacy specialist for infectious diseases at St. Luke's Hospital in Chesterfield, Missouri. He received his PharmD degree from the St. Louis College of Pharmacy. So, Eric, apologize, but I think it's pretty obvious you lost the coin toss on whose alma mater campus I was going to be on when doing this presentation. I'm actually on campus at Lenz. But Eric did get his PharmD degree from St. Louis College of Pharmacy and completed his pharmacy practice residency at Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond, Virginia. In addition to developing and maintaining the antimicrobial stewardship program at St. Luke's, Eric also serves as the investigational drug pharmacist, is on the P&T committee, the infection control committee, and is a voting member on the IRB. Dr. Schindler is an adjunct clinical assistant professor at his alma mater, St. Louis College of Pharmacy, and serves on the executive committee of his local St. Louis chapter of ASHP. So, Dr. Schindler.
All right, thank you, Scott, and thank you, Lynn. At first, I'm going to apologize. It looks like my slides, I had a different background on them, and then when they transferred to the background, they kind of came out a little funny looking. So I apologize if they are difficult to read. But first off, thank you, Lynn. I think you illustrated some excellent opportunities to collaborate with infection control professionals. I know that the infection control professionals in my institution have been very important in the development, support, and expansion of our program. In saying that, knowing how important collaboration with the ICPs are for pharmacy and the stewardship program here, I want to discuss other avenues and opportunities for antimicrobial stewardship program expansion. I first want to go over the history and initial progress of our program at my institution, pre-implementation of an internet-based surveillance system. Second, I want to present our study results on the effect of an internet-based surveillance system on our program. I'd also like to identify the critical issues we are facing today that has served as the backbone for further program expansion. And lastly, present the future goals of our program going forward. Next slide, please. So first off, a little bit about my hospital, St. Luke's Hospital in Chesterfield, Missouri. It's a 493-bed nonprofit community teaching hospital with specialty areas that include cardiovascular medicine, CV surgery, hem-onc, general surgery, orthopedic surgery, neurosurgery, neurology, and general medicine. One thing that I'd like to emphasize before I get too far into our program is that I don't think that the problems that we encounter developing, justifying, and expanding the program are unique to my institution, nor do I think the initiatives we have taken, have undertaken are unique. So I imagine many in our audience have encountered similar issues, pitfalls, and solutions. For those who have dealt with the same issues, I'll be interested in knowing how you've dealt with these universal problems, so feel free to discuss in the Q&A. And maybe for some who are in the planning and development stage of the program, maybe our initiatives I discuss will be helpful in your program development, maybe even research provoking. Next slide. Oh, wow. This really didn't turn out well. So in the pre-stewardship days at St. Luke's, we had many issues. Initially, there was unrestricted prescribing by our physicians. Any physician could prescribe whatever they wanted. Also, we had restricted access to physicians, leading to delays and barriers to order resolution when we did have an issue with a specific order. Initially, there was physician resistance to outside consultation, and you know, this was a problem that we were aware of, and other physicians were aware of. Our ID physicians were concerned of, you know, the antimicrobial usage. However, at that time, they're hesitant to implement restriction due to fears of decreased consultation and concerns of increased off-hours workload. At that time, the clinical pharmacist role was primarily educational, being involved with P&T committee, part of quality assurance investigation and protocol developments. But I think one of the stimuluses for our program started off in January of 2007 with the publication of the IDSA guidelines, the guidelines for developing an institutional program to enhance antimicrobial stewardship, again published in 2007. I said that was critical for the development, support, and justification of our early initiatives. Initially, what we did is that the pharmacy collaborated with our microbiology department, obtaining daily printouts of positive cultures and evaluating drug therapy. In July of 2007, the hospital obtained a surveillance system that provided a computer interface linking micro results and pharmacy records, allowing for initial framework for stewardship. Again, we had some initial barriers that we had to circumvent. Well, like I said before, we had limited physician access, so we circumvented that by the production of communication forms that allowed us to efficiently make recommendations on patients, allowing us to balance workload and triage less emergent interventions. We evaluated this and found that it was rather effective. We achieved a 75% compliance rate after an education and phase-in period, which was on par with public benchmark data. In August 2008, we purchased an internet-based surveillance system which had both infection control and pharmacy modules. This system provided the stewardship support in real time, allowing for rapid intervention. Next slide, please. Next slide. Thank you. The infection control module allowed us to use some user-defined alerts, identifying patients with MRSA, VRE, C. diff, to name a few, to help identify medication management opportunities. The pharmacy module allowed us to develop real-time interventions, identifying critical microbiological results early. It also provided us the opportunity for real-time drug utilization evaluation to identify drug use outside our guideline or institution recommendations. It is also useful in identifying patients with excessive antimicrobial combination or excessive duration of antimicrobial therapy. Next slide. Next slide, please.
Sorry, Eric. I'm having problems with the slides here, so I'm trying to get it fixed. I'm trying to keep up with you.
No problem. I'll try and slow down, too. All right. So after we implemented the internet-based surveillance system, we wanted to see how effective it actually was. So early in 2009, my PGY2 resident and I evaluated its effect on our program. We wanted to see if the internet-based surveillance system was additive to what we currently had in place. We looked at our program from January. Next slide, I think. We looked at our program from January to March 2008 for our control group, and in 2009 from January to March as our study group. The control group utilized the computer interface that we had in place at that time. The study group utilized the computer interface and the internet-based surveillance system that provided the user-defined infection control and pharmacy alerts. Next slide. I really apologize for these slides not showing up, but you can see a few of the study group alerts shown here were described earlier. Our real-time events were what we were attempting to capture. Our primary outcome, what we were looking for, was to compare the number of interventions identified. Next slide. Our secondary outcomes included the compliance rate of the recommendation, compliance rate of real-time interventions, and comparison of drug utilization. Next slide. So now that obviously the graphs have not come across either, so I'll try and briefly try and explain what these were attempting to show. It was a relatively small sample, and we were of limited duration, but we found that with the internet-based surveillance system added it to what we currently had in place, we were able to increase our overall recommendations by 50%. We found similar numbers of de-escalation opportunities, which in all honesty was the strength of the previous program that we still had in place, we were able to increase our ability to identify excessive antibiotic durations, and we were able to identify 13 critical real-time events in this time frame, which were not possible with what we currently had. And then with the increased number of recommendations, we saw similar acceptance rates among all the recommendations. There was a trend towards increased compliance with the real-time events. However, it wasn't of any statistical significance, likely due to our small sample. Next slide. And again, this was the slide looking at our compliance rates, which showed pre and post we had similar compliance rates, and then a trend towards increased compliance with our real-time critical results. Next slide. All right. So again, these are just bars for you here, but we did look at our drug utilization. It was a rather busy slide, but I'll just kind of go over what the gist of this was. On the y-axis was defined daily doses per 1,000 patient days, and on the x-axis was defined daily doses per 1,000 patient days, and drugs are on the y-axis. What we found was we did see a reduction in some of our broad-spectrum agents, specifically fluoroquinolones and third- and fourth-generation cephalosporins. We saw an increase in use of our anti-pseudomonal penicillin group, specifically piperacillin tazobactam. The rate of increase the rate of increase is around 30%. However, this was a lower rate of increase than what we've seen. We've seen over a 40 to 50% increase in the previous 2 years. So the increase was seen, however, it was not as great as what we'd seen in the past. And we saw an increase in use in some of our narrow spectrum agents, specifically our first generation cephalosporins, which we tried to emphasize the use of those in expense of our broad spectrum agents. Also, we saw an increase in both oral and parenteral vancomycin, which along with our piptazo use was stimulated further investigation.
I'm trying to open your presentation here somewhere else. Bear with me.
Okay.
I mean, it's worth waiting, I think, 1 minute so I can try to get up your presentation.
Sure.
I'm sorry.
That's all right.
It's something with the new word. I thought I fixed it. All right.
Hey, there we go.
All right. I'm going to move on to where we are.
Should we start over?
No. I'm going to try to catch up, though.
Okay. All right, that looks a little bit better.
Are you there, Eric?
I'm here.
Tell me where to stop.
Okay, I think this is a good port.
Okay.
Part to, so it can everyone's is this being broadcast?
I'm sharing it to everybody.
Okay. So in evaluation of our study, it provides some evidence that the Internet-based surveillance system was additive to our current process, providing opportunities for rapid intervention and allowed for customization based on your institution. Again, these results might not be extrapolated to other institutions due to different physician compliance. However, we were on par with previous published compliance rates. Additionally, the surveillance only identifies opportunity for intervention. Obviously, you need dedicated personnel and clinical judgment still obviously required. Again, what things that we did identify is that we saw an additive interventions, more recommendations available, but we felt it was kind of just the tip of the iceberg. We still had additional opportunities to look at some of the standard traditional stewardship initiatives such as IV to PO, renal dosing, et cetera. We did not specifically look at this in our study. So next slide. So in summary, our study suggests that an Internet-based surveillance system can increase overall recommendations. It was able to identify more patients with excessively long therapy. It showed positive trends in drug utilization, and through real-time alerting, increased high-impact recommendations by identifying critical events and intervening rapidly. Next slide. So as we stand today, essentially our program, it has increased our credibility amongst clinicians and our administrators. Unfortunately, despite our efforts, we've seen concerning trends involving antimicrobial therapy, specifically high C. diff rates, increasing antimicrobial resistance, and increased utilization of broad-spectrum antimicrobials. Next slide. In response to the concerns, we presented this data to administration and proposed initiatives for improvement. Next slide. First off, we identified the concern of increasing C. diff at our hospital. From December of 2008 through March of 2009, our rates of C. diff were above the national average in the endemic range of greater than 10 cases per 10,000 patient days. As you can see, our red line there is our mean, and that's been consistently increasing. And then in the last 4 or 5 months of evaluation, not only were we were above the national average and in the endemic range. Next slide. Now, these next two slides, I'm going to attempt to identify the antimicrobial risk factors for risk of C. diff. Multiple studies have suggested higher risk with certain agents. However, this study published in 2005 from CID shows that the majority of antibiotics increase C. diff risk, and suggests that fluoroquinolones may be the most strongly associated, which other studies have suggested as well. Next slide. This data from the same article is from the same article, but what the purpose of this slide is to show that for almost all antimicrobials, the longer the exposure to a certain antimicrobial, the higher the risk of C. diff. Next slide. So in summarizing to the administration, we wanted to emphasize appropriate duration of antimicrobial therapy and, when possible, de-emphasize reliance on fluoroquinolone antibiotics. Next slide. Next, we wanted to illustrate the trend of increasing antimicrobial resistance. This slide shows Pseudomonas susceptibility over a 4-year period of time. You can see for the vast majority of agents that resistance is increasing, and also on the bottom there, you can see that the absolute number of isolates encountered at our hospital were increasing as well. What we wanted to emphasize that in 2008, our fluoroquinolone resistance was 35% and increasing from previous 4 years. And probably most concern is that our cefepime resistance had tripled over a 3-year period of time. Next slide. So this slide looks at Acinetobacter susceptibility over the same time period. Now, the susceptibility fluctuates over the years with the respective agents, and the scale of the graph may lessen the effect. But the take-home point here is that compared to 4 years ago, our isolates of Acinetobacter doubled, and our most active agent is resistant more than 25% of the time. Next slide. Now, this slide looks at our 2008 susceptibility of our five most commonly encountered gram-negative pathogens to fluoroquinolones, our most commonly prescribed antimicrobial class at St. Luke's. These five species account for over 4,000 isolates, 2,000 of which being E. coli. The take-home point with on this slide is that with the exception of Klebsiella, these organisms are resistant greater than 16% of the time with our two most common pathogens, E. coli and Pseudomonas, higher than that, greater than 20%, and that's rising. Next slide. So in summarizing to the administration, we wanted to emphasize appropriate duration of therapy, specifically our broad-spectrum agents, and when applicable, provide decision support to enhance optimal empiric therapy to ensure initial susceptibility. Next slide. Lastly, what we wanted to identify and show present the concern of increasing antimicrobial use at our hospital. This slide, using 2004 data as our baseline, showed the rate of increased usage of piperacillin tazobactam, cefepime, and levaquin over a four-year period of time. You can see initial increases with cefepime and piptazo, and then a drop in cefepime use, partially due to the resistance trends that we've seen previously. However, probably most concerning to us is over a four-year period of time, we saw an approximate 50% increase in piperacillin tazobactam use. Next slide. Similarly, this slide looks at our gram-positive agents, specifically our newer semi-restricted agents with the exception of vancomycin. Again, this slide shows an increase of at least 25% and up to 50% for some agents over a 2 to 4 year period. In reviewing the hospital acquisition costs of these seven agents, linazolid, daptomycin, tigecycline, vancomycin, piperacillin, tazobactam, cefepime, and levofloxacin, in 2008, our hospital spent approximately $1 million on these seven agents, which showed an increase of $300,000 from just 2007 alone. So we were spending $300,000 more on these drugs than we were the year before. Next slide. So in summarizing to administration, we wanted to emphasize, again, appropriate duration of antimicrobial therapy, specifically our broad-spectrum agents, enforce enhanced restriction of our problematic agents. Next slide. So in order to attempt to enact all of our initiatives on antimicrobial therapy, we proposed an antimicrobial order form to offer decision support for empiric therapy, de-emphasizing certain agents, enforce restriction of certain agents, preventing excessive duration of broad-spectrum agents, all while preventing delays in effective therapy. Next slide. So as to why an antimicrobial order form for how it can help curb our issues, order reforms are recommended by the IDSA guidelines, although they're not a 1A recommendation, but they still are recommended. They've been shown to increase optimal therapy by 13%, increased susceptibility to empiric regimens by 23%, and have been shown to decrease overall antimicrobial consumption. And lastly, they've been well received with compliance rates of 77% in the literature. Next slide. So as to how can an order form help curb our issues, from our proposal to administration, limiting duration of therapy was critical for success, specifically our broad-spectrum agents. Through recommendations on the form targeting certain agents and emphasizing de-escalation. Let's see. I think if we can actually go back a slide, actually, if you don't mind. All right, next slide after this. So the customizable alerts that were developed in our internet-based surveillance were able to identify the patients in noncompliance, identifying intervention opportunities. Additionally, enforcement of restriction was another important aspect of our program success. Customizable real-time alerts developed were developed identifying patients receiving restricted agents upon initial prescribing, allowing for real-time DUE, and which allowed us to enact on these patients within 24 hours. Next slide. So in summary, our program initially provided reactive feedback but provided little impact on empiric therapy. We identified critical issues regarding prescribing practices that affected our hospital. We implemented prospective feedback influencing empirical therapy and identifying need and enforcement of restriction. We provided guidelines for appropriate broad-spectrum agent use with limits on duration. The internet-based surveillance system was critical to identifying patients who antimicrobial was not in compliant with the guidelines that we developed. With all of our extended programs, we had a high rate of physician compliance. And moving forward, with the development of this and with the support of the internet-based surveillance system, we were able to outline future quality assurance initiatives to further impact care. With that, next slide, please. I'd like to acknowledge a few people who have assisted me in the production with this project, my colleague Christy Burrows, who helped with our study, and our director of ID, Leon Robeson, and Thomas Pullman, our head of P&T, whose support has been critical to the development and the success of our program. Again, I apologize for the AV issues and some of the slides not showing up, and happy to entertain any questions that you guys have.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Eric. And despite the IT snafus of Microsoft Office, very well-delivered presentation. So thank you very much for that. That concludes our presentation. This is the point in our advisor lab where we'd like to invite everyone to ask questions or comment on the specific topics that Dr. Fehrenbacher or Dr. Schindler have presented. Tanya, would you please instruct our participants as to how to register a question, please?
Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then the number 1 on your telephone keypad. Again, that is star 1 to ask a question. And we will pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster. Again, that is star 1.
While everyone is kind of registering their questions, I actually have one that I'd like to pose to both Lynn and Eric. We did at Premier did a survey with Shea about a year ago that was published in January of this year that focused on adherence to the IDSA Shea guidelines. A year after those were published in January of 2007, we did the survey and basically found that there were less than 50% of our respondents actually had an active antimicrobial stewardship program in place. If you guys were to identify, you know, a single practice to help get a hospital pharmacy off the ground with an antimicrobial stewardship program, what would be kind of one high-level piece of advice you would provide to each one of them? And let's start with Lynn first.
Sure. I think, number one, it's important to focus on what your problems are. So I think identifying your problems, realizing that we have some universal things high level, but really getting to know what you have in your institution and what resources are available and making those key impact interactions with your infection control team, your IS team, your ID physicians, your administrators. I think if you want to start something basic and easy, if you haven't done it already, an IV to PO conversion or protocol that doesn't require physician intervention is a great place to start. It's typically easy for pharmacists to assess whether a patient could take something orally, and so many of our antibiotics have a very high bioavailability, and once patients are able to take orals, switching them over rapidly is high cost savings and good impact on the patient, too. Get the lines out, reduce the risk for line infection. So single easy starting point for me would be to encourage you to develop a good IV to PO conversion for antimicrobials.
Yeah, and I would mirror that. And I think from my program, I started from scratch as well. And I think kind of what Lynn said is collaboration. What I started at was essentially I would take 80 profiles and look at any patient who had an antibiotic and try and look at their cultures. And then I was able, through the committees that I worked on, uh, worked sat on, I got involved with our micro department and was able to get them to print out all the positive cultures, which, you know, expanded on that. And, you know, it only takes one or two significant interventions with your ID specialist to identify something they didn't see, for them to kind of open the door for you and then to be your advocate. I think it's just, you know, collaborating with those who are kind of trying to do the same thing to improve care, knowing that you can be a benefit to them. And then through them, they advocate for you and help you and give you support with future program endeavors.
Excellent. Thank you both. Tanya, are there folks waiting with questions?
You do have a question from Bree Watsack.
I'm sorry, it was already answered. Thank you.
Your next question will come from Lisa Fowler. One moment.
Lisa, are you there?
Yes, can you hear me now?
Yes.
All right. We were wondering if it is possible for Dr. Schindler to share the preprinted orders that he and his organization developed.
Sure. Yeah. Just if you want to submit your email, I'd be happy to send you our approved order set.
Or Eric, if you want to provide those files to me, I can post them with the presentation and the handouts all on the same site and send a link to that in a follow-up email. Will that work?
That'll work fine.
Perfect.
Thank you.
Your next question will come from Jennifer Robinson. Jennifer, your line is open.
Hi, this is Steve from Children's Hospital, Central California.
Yes, Steve.
Yes, hi. Hey, I guess Rich Sakai actually asked the question in the chat box. How are you able to justify your program to your administrators in terms of the money it cost to do such a program, manpower and all, and the PharmLink system? That system is not free. So we were wondering how you were able to fiscally justify this service.
I think that's a problem everyone is undertaking. I think that, you know, depending on how you quantify certain interventions or recommendations, I know you can look at, you know, our hospital uses Clinitrend, which significantly overvalues the interventions, and the value that they place on those. But I think overall, is that our hospital has actually, you know, been pretty. They haven't been steadfast to show the absolute money, and the fact that they understand how much value it is to get a patient who's critically ill and septic on an appropriate antibiotic early, and so they understand the value that has. So I haven't really had to, you know, send out the spreadsheet and say that this was a $50 recommendation or this service had that. I know it doesn't answer your question, and, you know, in the future I might have to do that, but right now I have not had to really get down to the bare bones justification for that yet.
Okay. You're fortunate. Thank you.
I know.
And Eric, I can chime in a little bit on that too. I'm in a similar situation as you, but I just want to emphasize to the group, while we all understand the bottom line and the need to justify every penny spent within the health system, it is important to note that the stewardship literature mentions cost as a secondary outcome. So I do think that we need to keep that in mind, that if we go into these programs for the sole reason of saving money, we're setting them up to fail. So I think it's important to be able to cost justify. For example, the catheter-associated UTI project that we're working on, I can show that in that patient population, hopefully we can reduce antibiotic use overall, I can then infer that I may save C. diff cases. But I think, you know, addressing global impact is very difficult to do. We don't know what the best measurement metric is, whether that's DDD, whether that's antibiotics per patient day. The literature is not standardized. It's my hope that in the near future, NHSN will have a benchmark so that we can compare antibiotic use against like institutions as easily as we can infection rates. So again, it doesn't directly answer your question. I haven't had my back held to the wall yet, but I anticipate that day is coming in the future, and hopefully there'll be more tools available to us as this gains popularity.
And your next question will come from Brennick Kosmic.
Hi, my name is Brennick Kosmic, also with Children's Hospital, Central California. My question was one to Eric and then one to both of you. Regarding your pre-printed orders and duration limits, I didn't know if the pre-printed orders had a duration limit on it, and if it does, how is that utilized? And then the second question would be is, you know, what is your daily time spent roughly for the stewardship program?
Well, one thing is that we envisioned or we thought about or threw around automatic stop dates. There was significant concern of that would leave a hole in therapy. So on our pre-printed order forms that have the IDSA endorsed guideline recommendations for empiric therapy, we also tried to give recommendations for criteria for DC of therapy. So they're, you know, recommendations 7 days, 10 days, somewhere around there, but there's no hard stop date. But what we have done is that from, you know, by, for example, we have a category of duration-restricted antimicrobials that, you know, might initially empirically be appropriate, such as Zosyn or Cefepime, but we recommend that they be reassessed by 5 days. And so what I've done is I have developed an alert in our internet-based surveillance system of all patients who have been on that agent greater than 5 days. So I get that alert, and then I look at the patient, and if they haven't drawn cultures or if cultures have been negative, I will put in a note to assess for de-escalation or DC of therapy if clinically stable. And so I use those duration of therapy recommendations as then customize those alerts to identify the patients who are whose physician prescribing is not in compliance with that recommendation.
And I think your second question had to do with the amount of time. I have alerts similar to what Eric uses, so I'm looking at certain drugs triggered by day 5 or day 7 of therapy, certain drugs triggered by day 1 of therapy, depending on, for example, colistin. I want to make sure that we're using that and dosing it appropriately in our patient population. Time is big. It's my full-time job. I also precept residents, so I usually have a resident on rotation with me, and I'm able to give them certain tasks as well. But do I get to every patient in my institution that I need to look at every day? No, I don't. I think that, again, we run an average daily census somewhere in the mid to upper 400s, and I'm really the only dedicated person to this. Not to discount the things that the floor pharmacists are doing out on the front lines, because they're actively monitoring for creatinine clearance adjustments. They're actively monitoring for IV to PO. So essentially, you could say that part of their day is dedicated to this as well, whereas I'm focusing more on the detailed backside de-escalation and things like that. So it's hard for me to estimate the total amount of time spent simply because we've got, you know, 15 pharmacists out on the floors who also do dedicate part of their day, but it does take time.
Yeah, I would agree. I think it's the majority of my day as well.
Your next question comes from John Phillips.
It's already been answered. Thank you.
And again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then the number 1. And at this time, you do have a question from Jolene Zeller.
We have, I'm from Avera St. Luke's in Aberdeen, South Dakota. We have both pharmacy and infection prevention in the room. And we're interested in the C. difficile studies that you performed, as well as in the CAP-associated UTI study. We knew that the presentation was supposed to be available online, but when we tried to download it earlier, we couldn't do so. Are the slides themselves going to be available online so that we can look in more depth at the criteria and so forth that you are using for that collaboration between infection prevention and pharmacy?
Lauren, can you answer that?
Yeah, no, we don't make the PowerPoint slides available. We just convert them to a PDF, and they are available online and can be downloaded. I've checked the link myself. Maybe you have a block on your system. Whatever the case, I can send you a when you get an email follow-up from me, my contact info will be in there. I can send you a copy of that PDF directly to your email if you can't download it offline.
That would be great.
Sure, no problem. Just make sure, and you'll get my contact information, and shoot me an email, and I'll get it out to you tomorrow.
That'd be great. Thank you, because that will help us. You know, we're constantly measuring and monitoring those C. diffs, but to be able to integrate the two professions and the two focus areas, that would be very good.
Tanya, do we have any more questions?
There are no further questions at this time.
Scott, do you have any last-minute thoughts?
Thank you all for joining, and certainly thank you very much, Lynn and Eric, for two very well-done presentations.
I apologize for the technical difficulties, but the slides are online. All the information is there. If you have any problems at all accessing them or the call, my information's there. Feel free to send me a note or call me anytime, and I'll do anything I have to get you the information. If the speakers can please stay on the line, I'd like to say have a good day and goodbye to everybody. Thank you for participating.
This concludes today's call. You may now disconnect.